Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The main team.
QNO.
This is scrap. This is going to get archived.
You think it might even get archived? That's good.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
A composite show, archive segments from previous episodes that got cut due to time. From episode 90. This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot civ issues in the forums.
Production decay.
The guy who brought it up just said, can someone explain what this is? And I think a lot of people don't know what it is. I don't think I even discovered it until I was playing on Monarch, because it's a rather obscure game mechanic.
I forget if I read about it first or just discovered it on my own.
Well, basically, when you're building something and you get, like, say, 30 hammers into it, and you switch over to maybe build a unit real quick or whatever, there might be a slight production decay on that unit that's now on hold. It'll lose hammers.
It prevents you from building up a phantom army.
Yeah. But I haven't noticed it.
Which could potentially be very exploitative. You build a phantom army and then switch into civics that would give that phantom army bonus experience points when they're built. Let the phantom army come off the assembly line and then switch back into civics that are more economically viable.
Yeah.
Not to mention not paying unit costs for the army while it's in the queue.
You still only build one unit per turn.
Well, yes, but if you're in a stage where it's like 5 or 6 turns per unit, then in the time that it would take to produce one unit, you can produce 5 units.
I have had times where I was producing a unit per turn, but it was usually pretty low levels, like a swordsman, and I had been chopping forests.
Yeah.
That's, yeah, considered aggression.
So the exact mechanic, for anyone who's curious, it's fairly simple. It's if a unit has been in the queue for more than 10 turns, or if a building has been in the queue for more than 50 turns, it will start decaying. Most people think it's one hammer, but it's actually percentage-based. It's 2% of the hammer investment for units and 1% of the hammer investment for buildings. So it could potentially be more than one hammer per turn. It will be removed from your progress. And this is a mechanic that does not scale based on game speed.
Oh, does it round up or round down?
It rounds up, so it'll always be at least one hammer lost.
Okay.
Which is why many people think it's just one hammer.
Because it's not going to be 2 hammers unless you have a unit that costs more than 50.
Right. If this is one of the few non-game speed scaling mechanics that gives the disadvantage to people playing on slower game speeds. Most of them favor people playing on slower game speeds.
Yeah.
But on Marathon, 10 turns is the blink of an eye. On Normal, it's a reasonable amount of time. So you're much more likely to experience hammer decay by shifting around your production queues playing on Marathon.
Right. Yeah.
I've never noticed it, though. I guess I didn't do it too much.
It doesn't draw attention to itself.
Yeah. You have to do a lot of queuing for it to have a really big effect.
You basically have to be trying to exploit the mechanic in order for it to show up. Or if you're like me, when I discovered it, I had a bunch of different things. Oh, I need to build this. I'll build that one later. Oh, but I need to build this. I'll build that one later. Okay, I'm building the fishing boat. Oh, but shoot, now I need a warrior. But my city just grew a population. I can start a worker now and have it be more efficient. And then
the ADHD approach to playing the game?
Yeah, and then stuff kept building up on the queue.
Always building, but never built.
Next thing I knew, I had lost 20 hammers on my work boat.
Oh, no.
I know.
Oh, no.
It was sad.
Work boats only cost like 25.
Hammers will start over.
What if workshops behaved like cottages? That has interesting gameplay issues.
Yeah, if workshops behaved like cottages, they would have a lot of detention time. Oh, that not kind of, that kind of behavior. Oh, I'm sorry. You're talking about something else.
I don't even know what you mean.
Well, cottages are very badly behaved, so if workshops behaved like them, then they would have a lot of detention time, too. I really had to explain it.
One thing I found interesting about that thread was all the references to, well, this is realistic, well, that is realistic.
Yeah.
Some pretty serious arguments in there about how hammer yields are more or less realistic in certain circumstances, and it all appears to be completely unironic.
Yeah.
Isn't it ironic?
Don't you think? That's your national hero, right, Dan? Canada's national hero?
Or maybe it's meta-ironic.
I thought that's Celine Dion.
And that's Alanis Morissette song I was...
It's ironic because it's not ironic. You'd expect it to be ironic, but it's not. therefore it's ironic.
I think workshops do grow the techs and to
civics.
Yes, thank you. Civics.
Yeah.
Later civics, yes. Increase the hammer production.
Yeah. What I'd been thinking, if there were going to be a workshops increase productivity over time like cottages, is that it shouldn't be like cottages where it's over a long time it gets higher and higher and higher and higher. It would be like you have to work them for a little bit and then they reach up their full level. Or maybe new techs would just unlock higher levels of workshops. And so you wouldn't be able to get to a level 3 workshop until you research something. And then as you work the cottages, then they'll upgrade to the next level.
Yeah, I think Bezran, who started this thread, yeah, was getting at that the hammer yield would increase like cottage yield increases over time when they're worked over X number of turns. But you could even look at the other way. What if we applied workshops and cottages so that there's a plateau that they reach until you reach a certain technology? So, for instance, a cottage could grow to, what's the run right before town?
Village.
Village, there, that's, yeah. It can only reach the maximum of village until X technology.
But one of the civics that gives +2 commerce for the cottage.
Towns. The free speech civic gives +2 commerce to towns, and then printing press gives +1 commerce to villages and towns.
Universal suffrage gives +1 hammer to towns. But one thing I was concerned about is if it's not tied to technology, then you've got a real problem.
Yeah.
Because once you get metal casting, you build that workshop, and if it can grow to a full-strength workshop just by working it like a cottage, independent of discovering new technologies, you can literally skip researching machinery and guilds and gunpowder until right before you're making the push for rifles. You can ignore those techs for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
And have much higher production, and I think that would be very easily exploited, just based on where it is in the tree.
Yeah, unless you started tweaking other things as well.
There'd be a big cascade of changes that go beyond the scope of what people are talking about in that thread.
Yeah.
To balance it out, yeah.
This game is won by production, and if you change workshops, you're going to change the nature of how you win the game.
Yeah, because workshops, one of their early roles is just if you have no production, it converts food into production. But late game, they actually become, well, production producers in their own right.
That's why the game is called hardcore. It's so in-depth. These workshops do help you get production from areas that have very low, like if you had a whole bunch of grassland, but you needed some hammers so the city could actually build something. And it can be very critical on where you put that workshop or cottage.
There's an enormous amount of minutia.
With cottages, one commerce is worth so much less than one hammer. There's no absolute formula, but I think when people talk about the relative values, strategic value, it's something like, I don't know, 4 commerce to 1 hammer. And so if any improvement grows by 1 hammer, that's a big jump, whereas if it grows by 1 commerce, that's a small jump.
Yeah.
To make something grow like that gradually, something you might want to do if you really wanted to make that work would be to double all hammer costs so that each individual hammer was worth less, and so it was more gradiated.
Hmm. Well, doubling hammer costs of everything wouldn't do anything except double production time.
The point would be to allow more gradiated changes between different hammer levels.
Oh, instead of +1 being 2 hammers to 3 hammers, it would be 4 hammers to 5.
Exactly, yeah.
And so it would be a 25% increase rather than 50% increase.
Yeah.
From episode 95...
Come on into the research lab where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future. Well, Sedbert started a topic about having a demilitarized zone in the game. Having a ceasefire, and then you can tell them you can't move this close to the border or something like that. It would actually be useful sometimes.
How would you keep units out of cities?
Well, it would have to exempt cities, I guess. Talking about the literal border.
Well, if you just captured a city, it's frequently on the border because their culture is pressing and your units are inside. You took a ceasefire and you didn't kill them off.
Well, that's why I said cities would have to be the exception. Nobody's going to expect you to not garrison a city. That would be silly.
Well, yeah, but that's my point, Ben. That's where most of the units stay when not at war, is in one of the nearby cities. And with a road or something, you can just get right back into the city on the turn you declare regardless. It's an interesting idea, but I don't know how it would work under the current culture mechanics.
Probably would be overly complex, and even in real history, it really has only happened like once or twice. I think it's an interesting idea, but I don't think there's a way of implementing this, really.
I'm not even sure it's an interesting idea. I'm not even sure what it adds or what the purpose of it is, except to reflect some minor cases in history that, like you said, are very few. very infrequent. I'm not sure what the gameplay edition is. So you can just have a threat. There are many ways to give threats. Saying, don't come towards my border, well, okay. But as we said, cities are there. What about workers? Do they count? Part of the big thing in civilization is watching the armies move forward, move towards your borders, anticipating the war. Taking that out, and they watch them move towards the demilitarized zone, you have to change the whole line of sight. I'm not even sure what the purpose of adding it is. Am I missing something in that threat?
Okay, first of all, I argue with your assertion that it's, you know, only been a minor occasion that a demilitarized zone has been placed, but once again, I'm Korean.
Yeah, but there we have one.
Second of all, the demilitarized zone, if it were added to Civ, I think it would be a way of implementing a ceasefire without actually ending the war. Now, I don't even actually really know why you would want to do it, because it would be the trade negatives still be there. And so, you know, why still be at war if you're having a ceasefire? But that's the same question I have about the actual demilitarized zone. Anyway, I would just say that if it were to add anything new to gameplay, it would just be to ensure that you guys are still at war even though there's a ceasefire. If the demilitarized zone were actually implemented, it would have to be really tiny, just like the real demilitarized zone is. Tiny relative to, like, the rest of the country. It's like 40 miles wide.
It would be nice to have more difference between ceasefire and a peace treaty, because there is technically a difference between the two, but you don't see it a whole lot in practice in the current gameplay format.
No.
But my problem with this rule is that you already have a really, really huge demilitarized zone when you accept a ceasefire, and that is absolutely everything within their culture borders. You can't move there unless you go back to war. If you force a peace treaty, then you force that condition for 10 turns. So I don't see, as pointed out, how this would add to gameplay. In real life, the whole concept of culture borders isn't quite the same as it is in Civ in a lot of ways. But because of the way that culture borders work in Civ, that functionally creates a lot of demilitarized zones, because otherwise, how would you establish borders between two countries in the game?
I know a lot of people like to say, and you know, I like to say, I like to have more options in my diplomacy screen, but I'm just imagining on the diplomacy screen talking about, okay, on, I realize we're coming up on hexes on Civ 5, but let's talk about Civ 4 specifically. Okay, you've got like this grid thing, it's like a spreadsheet, and you start talking about, okay, so this square and this square, do you agree that this is a demilitarized square, et cetera, et cetera? And just, besides being complicated, even if we say it really doesn't add anything, even if we do say, well, let's try to add it anyway, it just seems to be an unnecessary headache where, you know, we're starting to play spreadsheet. We get enough of that in real life when we have to use spreadsheets for real life things. Having that in the game. Ugh.
Something to think about maybe for Civ 5, where, you know, a lot of the armies are going to be moved out of the cities, and culture borders are going to be changed, and there are going to be independent city-states, which you could see as maybe demilitarized. You can't move your units close to them or whatever, and use those in negotiations. We'll see how that changes in the diplomatic engine. But for Civ 4, I just don't see a place for it.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot Civ issues in the forums.
This topic was started by CaesarPlayer995, and he asks whether it's a good idea to build labs when you're trying to build a spaceship, or whether you should just go ahead and build a spaceship parts. Now, as we know, the laboratory provides a boost.
Plus 50% spaceship production.
Yeah. Coming into this discussion was also the space elevator. Some posters said it was a joke, you don't really need to build it. I can see going for a spaceship win. I think it's probably worth it to build laboratories, especially if your techie's lower. You don't have all the techs to build all the spaceship parts just yet, so you can't build a spaceship part in every city. I also think that space elevator is not such a bad idea all the time, especially if you go straight towards satellites. And satellites lets you build the docking bay, which is one of the spaceship parts that requires the most hammers.
If you are going for spaceship victory, so long as you're building it in a city that has decent production capabilities, because if you don't have very good production in that city, then plus 50% isn't necessarily going to be that much an advantage to you. And considering how late game it is, unless you were going for spaceship production, unless it felt like an urgency in kind of the tech race that you needed that extra 25%, on top of the 25% that you would get from the observatory, which you would have to build in the first place, other than the spaceship production for the part that I said, in your decent production cities, that's fine. I think it's reasonable then, but you'd also have to take into account the other civs in the game, what their technology level is like, and you need to be watching
you get in-game notifications when Civ's built spaceship components. It may be that, okay, I need to build laboratories first before I build spaceship parts, but then by the time you build those, build the spaceship, someone beat you, and you could have really been in the race if you'd been building spaceship parts in the first place.
It depends on the attack path. Very frequently, the laboratories will be useful to speeding up your space race, while almost never will a space elevator be useful to speeding up your space race, just because of how it works. If you go for the internet, for example, labs win. You're going to go for superconductors and genetics next, or diffusion, but usually superconductors, because usually the bottleneck for a space race is not hammers, but rather tech rate. So you don't really lose a whole lot by stalling to build the laboratories, because you can generally finish the spaceship parts in your hammer cities before you can get to the next tech anyway. And for the commerce cities, which really shouldn't be building space parts anyway, by that point in the game, you're going to have your other research multipliers and everything else in place, and those cities are not going to have a whole lot to do. So you could increase your research rate decently, probably enough that it beats out building wealth by building laboratories in your commerce cities. But then in your hammer cities, the production bonus is usually worth it too, because the earlier space parts are a little weaker anyway. So you kind of want to front load your production, so when you get to really obnoxious things like the docking bay and especially the engines, you'll have enough production to put those out quickly. Now, the reason the space elevator sucks, and it sucks badly, it didn't in Vanilla or Warlords because the tech path was different, but in Beyond the Sword, they forced robotics to be required for it also. Robotics is not a necessary space tech, so you actually lose time going there. And for the majority of the space race wins, again, it's not production but tech rate that's holding you back. Blowing your time to go out to robotics is just going to slow you down leaps and bounds. The only exception maybe is if you get robotics from the internet or through a trade, and then somehow have great engineers to rush it quickly, or you just have so many cities with so many hammers that you can get away with building it and still not slowing down parts. But the number of games where it's actually useful or even doesn't slow you down to build space elevator are quite rare. Whereas with laboratories, I would say the majority of space race games, other than the odd one where you somehow have just ridiculous amounts of tech rate and not a lot of production or something, you're going to usually be better off with building the labs.
From episode 98. Started by Duck of Spades, he mentions just like they did in Civilization Revolution, should units be auto-numbered? This means, for instance, that if you built two warriors, then you would have first warrior and second warrior. It would actually be labeled as such in the game. It wouldn't just say warrior, or the more common that I would see it is, for instance, with armies. You have your 5th Legion army and your 6th Legion army, etc. And this thread also has a poll, which is always a bonus in trying to get chosen for a topic on this show. Options are yes, no, optional rule, and don't care. You actually have to disclose your vote. It's not a private ballot in this thread, so you probably should take about 10 seconds instead of 5 before you make up your mind. Leading actually is don't care, 39. Optional rule says 36. No says 10, and yes says 30. Really, I say this is a more lighthearted topic because it's one of those, well, if you want to use it, then it's great to have. But if you don't want to use it, then it's kind of one of those things you might see on screen but not have register there, but you don't really care. I think it would be nice if units were auto-numbered like they were in Civ Rev. Be a nice touch. But as I said, if it's something that you really didn't care about, then you might as well vote yes, because what difference does it make if it is? Use it if it's there, use it if not.
I actually don't like it, and not because I don't want them named uniquely. One of the funnest things in some games is to name your units. I would like it if there was a random name generator in the game, so that you kind of feel more attached to Urk, the barbarian warrior who survived. You know, that's what I generally do, is if I have a unit who distinguishes himself in battle, I'll give him a name. I think it'd be kind of neat if they started with a name, and that way I'm going to remember his name now.
I don't think that's useful at all. I'd rather have my units all be cannon fodder.
Take a hybrid of what I was saying and what you were saying, Michael. Have them start off just as a number, but then if they distinguish themselves in battle, perhaps they get a randomly generated name.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of neat, too, and that way you don't have to pull from quite a large pool of names. And I also like the whole Legion thing. Different legions of troops will often give themselves names as well, even if they're not successful, which is kind of funny. And certain groups like the 101, right, that get a reputation over the years. Bad reputations, the light cavalry, the light horse from the British Army, failed miserably. Their name. So I think that's much more interesting than first, second, and third.
If you want to have your units auto-numbered and you're playing Civilization 4, you can just install the Buffy mod, which does it for you. They actually do exactly what this poster says, Warrior 1, Warrior 2, Warrior 3. I think I like the second option better, where if a unit distinguishes himself in combat, you could name him. Because otherwise, people who make mass numbers of units, at some point you really run out of names, especially if somebody builds, like, I don't know, 500 units or something. Are you really going to have 500 names? What are you going to do after you run out? Are you going to have Venture Person Getterix Jr.?
Are you really going to have 500 units?
Well, that's why you want it randomly generated. You wouldn't want to have it so that your unit distinguishes himself in battle. And by the way, when I say distinguish, I mean actually do something good. Probably wouldn't want to say, hey, where did my unsuccessful legion go to? And that'd be their actual name.
On the other hand, that could be really funny light humor, though. You've got a unit that fled from two battles in a row and survived. You could have a pool of silly names for people like that.
What, like Yellow Pants or something?
Yeah, you know, Eric the Unworthy or Brave Sir Robin.
Yeah, like Ethel Red Dawn Ready.
So yeah, it doesn't have to be military might that wins you a name. It could be quite entertaining to pull off silly, you know, quote-unquote achievements, and as a result, get a funny name for your unit doing that.
In Civilization Revolution, the auto-numbering is, if you build, like, five Legion armies, as an example, and you lose three, then if the two Legion armies you have left standing are 2 and 5, then that number is still there. You can go to the military advisor and see how many particular units of a particular type you have. I suppose as a visual glance, without having to go with that screen, you could click on a unit and be like, oh, okay, so this is my third knight, so that means I do have a couple of others somewhere. Now I'm really jumping off the deep end, but hey, while in the pool.
Yeah, I'm actually thinking of other ways that units could get named. Units that have traveled to a certain number of cities, units that have traveled to a certain number of continents, units that have obviously won certain battles, units that have killed animals, especially ships. Ships that have actually survived combat, especially in Civ 4, because navies just sink so much, are certainly worthy of names.
Seems like a lot of developer resources to pour into something that's even easier done by humans, though.
Whoa, hey now. Wetter has introduced something interesting here, that developers are not human, so what are they? They're automatons.
Everyone knows developers are superhumans.
Oh, good save, yes.
There's a guy in this thread that tries to impose authority. Will not happen, period. Of course, the thread continues on without him.
Should army production reduce civilian population? Krilgor says high productivity or a strong economy doesn't always mean the ability to produce a large standing army, and basically says that the missing element in civilization seems to be population factor. He goes on saying that in the real world, one of the key factors in determining the size of a standing army is population. For example, China has the largest army and the largest population. Says this isn't factored in enough in the game. I guess I could agree to a certain point.
Yeah, it's really interesting, actually. Because if you think back to medieval Japanese warfare, the majority of the troops on the field were running around with wooden sticks, not metal swords. That's purely a population-based army, not an economic army.
A militia, yeah.
An economic army means that you can equip the guys. It doesn't mean that you can field the guys. Somebody else in this thread later points out that China's reducing their army because they don't have a modern army with that number of people. They've just got that number of people in the army, whereas the United States has a large army where they're spending a lot of money equipping them, training them. So if you think about it in Civ terms, that time you spend building a unit, in quotes, is really time spent equipping and training people to fight a certain way, certain tactics, at a certain level of expertise, compared to just simply having people on the field. When you draft, you're basically saying, we have in economic surplus the equipment, but we don't have people assigned to that equipment, so we'll just pull them directly out of the population right now. So it seems like at any one particular time, you should be able to say, here's this amount of population, we're going to put them in the field, they're untrained, they're unequipped, go for it. And whatever level of technology you have at the time, whatever level of economy you have at the time, you can put into giving them the worst you possibly can at that particular point. It seems like Civ 5 may have an answer to this, though, because I vaguely recall that you can attach military units to cities and it increases the city's defense, which suggests to me that the people of the city are the ones that are defending the city.
That makes sense, or at least are supporting that particular troop's efforts more directly and more efficiently, allowing them to fight better, stronger, longer, or both.
Yeah.
Wouldn't this actually be better than limiting the amount of units you have by the amount of resources you control? Instead, actually, the amount of units you have should be limited by population as well, then.
But maybe that's exactly what Civ 5 does.
Well, it has been mentioned that if you have a particular iron resource, then that will only be able to support X number of units, but those are your quote-unquote properly trained units, or as a poster in this thread later would describe them, Marthot Dubois calls them like regular, quote-unquote regular units, where those are the ones that not only are the numbers, but they're properly trained and they have the proper equipment.
Yeah, and those are a much smaller portion of medieval warfare, essentially. It's sort of post-medieval warfare when there was an abundance of advanced weaponry started to fall into the hands of citizens of countries. That's when things started to change and the concept of having fully equipped large armies became much more important. And that really, I guess you could almost say that came directly from Khan, equipping his people en masse and training them en masse. He had a huge army that knew how to ride and had great weapons, and no one could stand up to him.
For all you nerds out there, that's Genghis Khan, not Kong Noonien Soon from Star Trek. So we make that clear?
It even happened in Japan when they were fighting the feudal wars and trying to come up with new shogun. The more that the samurai died, the more the civilians would hoard their weapons and armor. And slowly but surely, it sort of spread out. The kind of equilibrium of military technology was taken away from the elite. But the technology moved on. Then you got guns. And then that kind of became equilibrium, especially in the Wild West in the United States, mass production of guns. Whereas that was still dominated by military and nobles in Europe. And then slowly that became the equilibrium sort of just everywhere. And now you have tanks and mech infantry. The average person on the street does not have such things. If there were a giant civil war or giant world war, that sort of weaponry would become communal eventually. And that would be a shockingly weird world to live in. But then you could say the same about if you go back in time to when guns were a new thing, the idea that the person on the street, the blacksmith down the road, might have a gun in his closet to defend himself would be crazy.
Yeah, no, all this discussion, it's making me think of a bit more of a streamlined approach to reflecting that real-life aspects as compared to what you see in, say, Civilization IV colonization or colonization before that, where some of your production and resources, it was actual weapons, for instance. I said I've gotten hazy on the particulars, but you would actually need that in order to be able to equip better units. Is that, am I remembering correctly?
Yeah, and maybe that's part of Civ 5 because you have fewer military.
Yep.
Which means there's more emphasis on what they can do. You don't really want to lose a unit. If you've only got 5 units defending a city and they're spread out around the city, one hole in that line could be fatal.
I'll nitpick less military units. They could still be representing the same numbers as we've always had, whatever that number happens to be. But yes, less units.
Yes and no. I mean, you lose that square, you've lost that part of the field of battle. Even if it represents 10 million people there, it's still a fully fatal loss. Whereas in Civ 4, it couldn't ever represent 10 million people in a single square because you would stack up multiple units to represent 10 million people. Much harder to lose that.
Yeah, more like in Civ 2, if you had multiple units on a tile and one of them lost, then everybody lost. You could get around that if the tile had forts or something like that.
Something silly like that. And I know in the base mods, is it called Final Frontier in Civ 4?
And Civ 4, the official one, yeah, Final Frontier.
Yeah, the units stacked on top of each other have a penalty. But Civ 5, you've only got one unit on that square, so you really need to pump your economy into keeping those units really up to date. And I think that's fairly representative of reality, but this guy really makes a point here that when the shit hits the fan, you've got all these people, and they have last generation's military tech at their disposal. That guy, the blacksmith down the road that doesn't have a gun because that's inconceivable, that dude has a sword. That's last generation's military tech, and he can still fight hack and slash, and he will defend his homeland, especially if you force him to. So I think it's a really valid point that population does equal military strength when you need it.
you know, to the sources where you're getting from, like, population to getting more of the militia type, and then those who are more regular, quote-unquote regular type, the better trained but less numerous ones. Back to poster Mathieu Dubois, I mentioned he talks about there should be three types of units, he's arguing, kind of an extension of this. You've got, I already mentioned the regular. He's saying these are the ones that cost food. Militia, your drafted are auto-form units, for instance, that might appear if enemy units are close to the city. So they, people take up arms, the citizens take up arms. That costs population. And then we've talked about mercenaries on Polycast before, where, of course, then in this case, he says it doesn't cost resources or population, but have a high gold upkeep and are very expensive to hire. So this way, it is affected by population. Your military and army production can reduce your population, but if you're a little better off in terms of food production and or gold, and you want to get your army that way, then there's still a population effect, but not to the same degree. So you're taking it from different sources, and each of the regular militia and mercenary have different strengths and weaknesses, depending upon what it is you want the army for, and how in the hell you're going to be able to raise an army in the first place.
Well, actually, that comes back to curry favor with the city-state by defending them. Well, that's mercenary action right there. So if you do it for free, you're going to get diplo bonus. If you do it for money, then you're going to make some money. So if another nation needs troops and they have the money to pay you and you're trustworthy, then you may as well commit your troops to their cause without actually having to gift them units.
In this poll, and again, polls are a great way to get on the show. I don't think I can say that enough. Currently leading is actually, yes, it should slightly reduce the city population. Then there's no, it should not have any effect on a city's population. And then closely is it should be an option which can be turned on or off. No.
Yeah, no, I think it's a balancing act, right? So people consume food no matter what. If you've got a standing military, they're consuming food and giving you no production, and in return they're giving you the ability to defend and attack things. If in a pinch you need to get more military to defend yourself, then you're clearly not going to put the economic hammers into producing your regular army, but you're no longer producing the food with those people. So if you have excess food, you can get away with it. If you don't, you have a limited time frame before you run out of food and people starve. So I think it's a good strategic play on how you manage your city, how desperate you are, all that sort of stuff. I love it. I think it would be great.
It would also force you to get more aggressive and try to shorten the war somehow, because otherwise your resource yield is slower than normal.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as you commit those excess population from production into military, you can no longer build military at the same rate that you did. So you've only got your last generation's worth of military technology population to defend yourself with. Unless you've got a super city that had lots of excess, lots of great people generating artists sitting around fluffing, doing nothing, you put them in the field and you get your people to actually go out and defend yourself, then essentially you were saying, I'm not going to spend money on military, I'm going to let my economy grow. So if you can flexibly grow and shrink your military like that, I think that's cool.
Yeah, unrealistic, more realistic.
Yeah, I mean, it's a trade-off, right? If you spend all those hammers producing a regular army, and then later you decide you want to merge them back into the city, which sounds like something you can do in Civ 5, then you're throwing away the economic hammers that you put into them to begin with. Say it costs you 10 gold to equip a tank, and then you disband the tank. You don't get that 10 gold back, but you do get your population back, which you can put into production or food or whatever it is.
It's kind of like, say, in Warcraft, when your settlement is throttled and you press the button, call to arms, then the people that are working in the city, like they're working on their farms or whatever, they stop what they're doing, they pick up in order to defend the city, and then you have the ability to tell them, okay, go back to work, put down your arms.
Yeah, and I think if you're in real trouble, you would just say, everyone stop producing, everyone stop farming, everyone go fight, and really, really hope that it doesn't last longer than 3 turns.
What's the point of producing stuff that we're not going to be able to use because, you know, we're all going to be dead?
Right, we're going to die either from the attackers or from starvation, so we may as well attack right now.
So with that, actually, Cowboy Tony, post 41 in the thread, said, I'd be happy for it to cost population, but with two caveats, that it shouldn't be a much smaller reduction than an entire Civ 4 population point, so perhaps you could increase the population count by a factor of 10 and then reduce population due to drafting by single digits. Nah. But there should also be a mechanism to resettle unwanted troops to regain the population or a percentage, which you kind of already just started to get at.
Although it sounded like in Civ 5, when you settle a military unit into a city, it adds to their defense. So it's like, what, these people can't go back to a normal life after being in the military? That seems a little bit odd to me.
Yeah, well, that's why he's saying a mechanism to resettle unwanted troops to regain the population. They could go back to, okay, you started off not being military, you have now been military, okay, thank you, go back to doing what it was that you were doing before.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
The other kind of point to this is, depending on the kind of military you've built, think about the Romans, right? Their military included engineers. So when they got somewhere, they set up shop, and those shops became full-on towns, cities, nations down the road. If you take an army out to the field for a fight and win, but there's nothing settled up there, you may as well just settle down. Basically, get rid of the settler unit, get rid of the worker unit. It's just people. The only thing that's going to cost you there is you equip those people and you lose the equipment. It's gone. If you wanted to get an army out of that city, you need to grow it up and then you need to put hammers into building a new army, so on and so forth. But it seems like that would be an easier mechanic. Mathieu de Blois, I think maybe that's how you say his name, I don't know.
It's maybe de Blois. Whatever. Okay.
Yeah. He reckons one unit is roughly 10,000 people. I don't know. That seems awful period-centric to me. Even in Egyptian times, they had militaries much bigger than that.
No, one unit is pretty accurate for ancient Egypt. I actually had this discussion a couple of times from Call to Power mods.
What about prior to that and after that?
Yeah, no, I think in really early times, it was actually much smaller. One military unit would be, especially in like ancient Babylon, only a few hundred people.
Mm.
And of course, by the time of World War II, it was sometimes 100,000 people, or certainly in the tens of thousands. So yeah, it is definitely era-specific and to some extent region-specific as well.
But I don't disagree with some of the other things he says. So I would love to see more fluidity between what the population means.
Yeah, in general, I think it's making the game unnecessarily complicated, just adding stuff on top of stuff. I think we're already making some massive changes to the combat model in Civ 5. Let's see how those work out first before we worry about making it even more complex.
First Civilization 5 strategic view screenshots. This is news. This is interesting.
Yeah, this is actually pretty interesting.
It's a top-down view of the world, board game style, where you sort of see the borders of everything, where all the cities are. I don't see military units on this, though. Maybe it's a layer thing. Maybe you can turn them on and off.
Yeah, the boss does talk a lot about a lot of layers, but it doesn't actually show off any of the layers, which is kind of stupid, actually.
Some of these symbols are interesting, though. There's a symbol here for bed and breakfast. Okay, maybe it's not a bed and breakfast. It just looks like a bed and breakfast. I guess that's the symbol of a town? Farm?
Some of those symbols could be units, too. Like in the...
Yeah, there's a little sword there, actually. And there's another one with a hammer. Oh, maybe it's an axe. There's a little horse head thing.
Oh, right. Yeah, those are actually units. We have seen those in screenshots as well.
So I guess strategic view to the developer who made this means make everything an icon.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
Whereas I think I would have preferred it if it were more like a chessboard so you can still see the units, but maybe that's really the main view. I sort of wonder as a user interface designer myself, what does it mean to need a strategic view for the main view of the game? Is there something wrong with the main view of the game? Is it too much information overload? Is it information underload? What's the failure?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Isn't it all more or less the same than we already had in Civ 4?
Where you zoom out to the planet?
Yeah.
This is much more precise. You can see a lot more information with this, that's for sure.
To actually look at the first of the three screenshots and then at the last one, there is a lot more stuff enabled in the last screenshot I see now. And you see, I guess, what are tile improvements or whatever they are. It looks something that looks like a mine. The units, you don't see those in the first screenshot. So I guess if you just enable one layer and you want to look for a specific resource or a specific unit, it's probably easier to find them on the main map where you see everything at once. If you only want to look at a subset of information, it could be useful, man.
Yeah, I guess my thoughts are, is it the terrain graphics that make the main view too difficult to use? In which case, wouldn't you just merge these two things?
Yeah, I mean, if you have terrain and you have tile improvements and you have units, I do have this problem in Civ 4. There's so much stuff on the screen sometimes, it's hard to make out exactly what you're looking at if you're looking for something specific. Especially finding a specific resource. Oh, where's the coal? I just discovered coal. Where on the world are all the coal resources? It's helpful to only enable that.
I'm not a fan of what the Mian team does, which is to have the resource icons floating about all the time. Those annoy me. They get in the way, in my opinion.
I do that as well, but even then, you can disable all the other resources. In the strategic mode in Civ 4, you can only show strategic resources. then you don't see the grain and the bananas and all that sort of stuff. You only see coal and iron. That's a helpful view.
So I guess it's going to be an interesting thing to experience, see how it actually gets involved. It looks like it would be incredibly difficult to play the game from this view.
Yeah, I guess we don't know that. In Civ 4, you definitely can't play it from the strategic view. It's just not possible to select units and stuff like that. I don't know how it will work here. But I have to say, it looks very pretty.
I disagree. I think compared to the actual game visuals, this looks...
Yeah, it's a different style, of course.
Am I playing Settlers of Catan? Or what?
Yeah, exactly. It really looks like a board game, like you said.
And it feels to me like if this is the strategic view, I'm looking at the bottom screenshot where all the layers are clearly turned on.
Yeah.
I don't want to play it like that. When I think of strategic view, I'm thinking, what is my military layout? How screwed am I right now? So I would just want to see the military tiles.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I don't think you want to have all the layers on. That's probably not very helpful in most cases. That's just information overload.
And I wouldn't want to play the game from this mode. This is something that I'd go from time to time to get a strategic overview.
If you have enough time on the turn timer.
Maybe it is useful with the new combat system. Where you have ranged units, it might be useful to zoom out a bit. I don't know. We don't know.
Fair, fair.
Has anybody shown off this stuff? I haven't seen screenshots like these of Civ 5.
No, this is definitely new.
This is first time in public.
We had seen a button that was labeled strategic view, but we never knew what it was for. So I guess now we do.
People asked, and 2K and Firaxis said politely, later.
Later? And now we do.
And now later is here. From episode 99...
There's another thing about the vassaling I really hate is when you're like 1-2 turns away from capturing the capital, and then that civ vassals to someone else. Now all your units are ejected out the territory on the other end of the world.
Oh, yeah.
You should at least be given the option to declare on both of them before you magically warp off the map, practically.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, Civilization X is vassaling to Civilization Y. Would you like to declare war on Y?
I had a fun game once, well, not too long ago, where that happened in reverse, though. I was actually playing with Lisa that game, and I had a defensive pact with an AI. I think it was either headed for her or for me. I think it was for me. And one of us closed borders, so it got expelled out of a person's territory. And then it declares on me, and I had a defensive pact with another AI. So like it expelled the AI 30, 40 tiles off to the side somewhere, and then it couldn't attack me because it was being blocked. It's just hilarious. But yeah, why can't you just automatically not be expelled all the way across the map?
So the number of times you can count where that has happened in your favor is maybe one or two. And the number of times where it has happened against your favor is an
Well, let's not go there.
Exponential of 10.
It's happened a lot in my favor, but only because I purposely tried to force that to happen.
Oh, yeah, in one of those deity games, I saw a big Civ fan get one of the AI stacks, like 50 to 100 units, something huge, locked up in another AI's culture with closed borders, and he couldn't move, and he just took all the AI cities and peace before the other AI could get out.
He took the other AI cities by boat?
No, it was all on land. It was one of the Immortal University games, but a big Civ fan turned it to deity. I think we were Russia and Montezuma was immediately bordering us, and Montezuma attacked somebody else and took a city. So a big Civ fan waited until they took peace, and that city was surrounded by culture, declared on Montezuma, and just swept all the cities, and was able to get peace again before Montezuma could get a stack out of there. This is trapped in the other AI's culture, and they didn't have open borders. Yeah, there's some pretty interesting stuff you can do to the AI.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at the Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net. record date is sorted 2010. Civilization 4, Warlords, and Beyond the Sword sound clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.